The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast.
Hello, F.
Today, we had the great pleasure to have Aaron Tweet. Aaron's an executive coach and a friend, and he specializes in coaching people through the interview process for jobs in the tech space, and I thought that this would be a very interesting conversation to see if there's any kind of cross-pollination in ideas and concepts that could be implemented in the healthcare profession. Actually, Miguel got like a free consulting session, so I guess he
We're
liked it.
We're totally going to have him on the show every month.
every month to get free work.
Stick around. It was great for you out there on the interview trail, for you out there maybe mid-career changing jobs. Lots of nice little pearls that you could take to heart and, you know, have potentially more success. So Stick around.
Thanks.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Today we have a great guest here, Aaron Tweet. And Aaron, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Lucas. My name is Aaron Tweet, and I'm an executive coach. And I say executive because we're all the CEO of our lives. And ultimately, what I do is I serve my clients by helping them manage the most difficult conversations of their lives and careers to make quality decisions. I had a long career in corporate America, tech, and small business. And ultimately, I realized that the people who are most successful in a variety of roles and fields are the ones who can manage the conversation. Managing the conversation is the most important skill set I believe that any human can learn, because we are the nexus of all things that happen to us. And when we're able to manage all of those individual conversations better, then our lives are much more improved. And the most important conversation to manage is the one with yourself.
Awesome. So the idea of, you know, that we were talking because we're kind of friends offline, and we were walking over to Andrew Schultz comedy show, and you were mentioning you know, that you're working in helping people more in the tech field go through the negotiations of their contract and how to kind of visualize and what language to use when going into those discussions. And I thought that was super interesting. And, you know, given the kind of impact of tech, especially in Austin, but all around the world, I thought that, oh, maybe we could learn something from another kind of high in demand field of how things are done. But obviously, you just made an intro that you cover a way broader topic. So why don't you, do you have any questions, Miguel?
I do about him. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a good starting point.
So why don't you take it away a little bit, Aaron, about more, you know, the overall picture, just like you started talking about before, and then we can dive into more nitty-gritty on how you help people negotiate contracts in other fields.
Sure. So ultimately, talking about salary negotiation in tech, you know, I have such a passion for this topic, and, you know, it's one of the things I help my clients with. But I love it so much because I spent 11 years in tech in a function called compensation. So the function of HR that determines what to pay everyone. And I did that at four different companies. I was at SpaceX for a long time, Activision Blizzard, DoorDash, and I started an executive compensation at a company called AECOM, big Fortune 500. So all that experience of learning how to price jobs top to bottom, left to right throughout an organization, having all those internal conversations about who gets paid what, made me really passionate about this is knowledge that everyone should have. And so it's why I also feel very qualified in helping the people I work with navigate all the career conversations, advocate for themselves and negotiate for their worth when it comes to how much they're paid. So really it starts out like this. You should know that you can negotiate, you should, and you're probably expected to, but that's something that's not really ever explained. And the negotiation starts on the first phone call in the tech and, you know, Fortune 1000 type roles outside of medicine. Negotiation starts on the first phone call when the recruiter says, what are your salary expectations? like they usually know their numbers, but the game starts right in the beginning. And that's actually a crucial area in the early on where I think a lot of people potentially can paint themselves into a corner by actually answering that question. So I'll pose it to you guys like this. When's the last time you bought a car? You went on the lot. What was the first thing they said to you?
How much do you want to pay?
Exactly. And so you already know what car we're talking about, what the finance terms are, so on and so forth. You answer that question, you fall into their frame. So when the recruiter in a job interview search scenario says to someone I'm working with, what are your salary expectations? They answer just that question, they fall into their frame. And it's the first phone call, so they don't have leverage yet. They haven't gone through the interview process to showcase their skill sets. They also haven't seen the full scope of the role. They don't know exactly what they're getting themselves into usually. And also, it's just talking about salary, especially in tech, and you know, so maybe some Wall Street type roles, some sales roles in different industries. There's additional components of compensation beyond salary that are sometimes very quite meaningful. So in tech, sometimes there's a bonus, but usually it's about the equity. So that comprises total compensation. So your salary plus the equity, if there is a bonus, adding all that up is really the true number that people should really focus on and be most interested in. So different companies have different compensation philosophies. And think of it as like a pie chart, the ratio of how much you get paid in salary, a bonus, or equity changes from company to company. So when they ask you only about one of them up front, it's too early to tell. So I like to coach my clients to say, I'm so glad we're talking about this topic. What is your company's compensation philosophy for this role? That way you can extract information and ultimately punt. Because as I mentioned, you haven't built your leverage yet by going through the interview process, and you don't understand the full scope of the role and how much you're going to have to put into it, what the true value that you'll be able to provide there is. So early on, it's, in my opinion, something that's, it's too much to say up front. There are exceptions to that, but in general, you want to get more information and then move through the process.
I think that we're not that far apart in medicine. As you're speaking about this, yes, the conversation about additional value or non-tangible that value in the form of options or equity or safe notes or whatever you want to call it, that doesn't really become part of the conversation in medicine unless you're talking to a very large private group. And usually it's a process of you have to earn your way up to there, to the table. And then you almost have to buy yourself in. But most of our listeners, Aaron, of course, are in healthcare, but there's a lot of people in the sales part. And so anyway, specifically about the medicine, I think that what's important, and this is actually the time where a lot of the younger guys are coming out of training and they're negotiating their contracts. So I think this is going to be a very interesting, you know, compare and contrast and use and learn and use some tactics of other industries. But one of the things that I would always invite people to understand is their bonus structure. Yeah. In what we specifically in medicine look at is also a thing called like work RVUs, which essentially means units of work for, it's a very convoluted way that the healthcare has pushed us into these contracts that are really abstract. And so certain procedures have a certain value and you have to have a certain amount of these value notes to substantiate your salary, but then there's some bonus structures that come from that. But it's really about understanding the power of your position to negotiate. But I love what you're mentioning, which is essentially, and I don't know, this might be a misinterpretation, but my understanding of your words and my own is don't commit before you've made yourself shine good enough or well enough to the point that you know they want you. And at that point, you are essentially, you've created your advocacy on the front end, and now you can have that discussion, right? Now when you understand, you read the room, you read the recruiters, or you read the people that are going to be your bosses, you understand what their needs are, you know what they're looking for, and you realize that you're an actually great candidate for that position, and you know your own worth, now you monetize that worth, right? That's kind of what you're saying. Is like, don't jump too early until you've learned the lay of the land and where you're going, and then use that towards your own advantage. Was that a misrepresentation, or am I?
No, you interpreted it just the way I intended. Okay. It's very astute. I think, and there's a lot of pre-work. I give, you know, when I do group trainings, I give a pretty awesome presentation on this topic. But the point is, the longest part of the presentation is the prep before the actual negotiation. As far as understanding your market value, understanding how you're going to explain and communicate that value, how the role and the skill set that you have, what other jobs pay, and how you aggregate that data so that you can come into this conversation with a philosophy. Because sometimes recruiters, you know, certain companies, they pay very well and they'll say a range, and you're like, assuming I'm towards the top end of that range and the equity and bonus is good, then conceptually I'm aligned. You know, like, it doesn't always have to be a rock and roll negotiation from the get-go. The important thing is to have that clarity of what the landscape is, as you mentioned, so that you can catch that, they're asking me about what I want. We're having this dialogue. Maybe they say a range and it's not great. You know, how do you handle that initially? Just being able to have that skill and data to flag a litmus test of whether something's going to work for you up front or not is very important. That way you don't proceed unknowingly.
How can you, so say the range that is mentioned is kind of a low ball. How do you advise people to proceed in a constructive way to see if that's just a bluff or, and there's room for negotiation, and how to identify where that is what it is, and then you don't want to waste your time and you just walk away in an amicable way and not in a confrontational or negative way?
Yeah, sure. Great question. Several layers to this, or several angles of entry. One is just the way I have clients phrase things is by asking, what is the compensation philosophy designed to elicit more than just salary? So hopefully, you know, in this scenario, they would, if they say a salary that sounds low, but they also say, well, there's an equity opportunity, so on and so forth, then you would have to make your assessment about, is this company, it's a Series A, Series B, whatever the case, maybe it's public. Is this going to be something where I feel that there's that truly a good shot at an asymmetric upside that could make up for a lower salary, right? Different companies, different compensation philosophies, companies in different stages have different compensation philosophies. If you join a seed stage startup or, you know, even up to say Series B, those companies really rely heavily on the equity prospects of upside as an incentive for employees to join from a compensation perspective. Then there's also your position. You know, I've helped people who, hey, I got laid off and I need help finding a job and then negotiating that after going through all the interviews. Then I also have people who are like, I'm a VP at a great company looking to switch companies. So I have a lot of leverage. And especially in situations like that, where you can just say, hey, that range actually sounds lower than it's going to take for me to move out of my position. I really appreciate this conversation. If there's any way we can have a discussion about up-leveling the role or, you know, going back and doing some work around what your total compensation philosophy is, I'd be willing to continue the conversation. But at this juncture, those numbers are not compelling enough for me to switch.
What do you feel is more important? Selling yourself, making yourself shine as a really nice object that these people should be interested in you? Or knowing their ethos, knowing what makes them bake and what they're looking for.
I'd say you can't sell yourself without knowing their ethos.
Okay.
Because part of how I coach people to interview, because like, yes, I help people with negotiating salaries, but there's no salary or offer to negotiate if you don't get the job. And so interviewing well so that you are the standout candidate is the first thing I help people with. And one of the things, my principles there is rounding up your answers. So it's answering the question they didn't ask. A lot of times, especially in tech, Fortune 500, there's across a variety of roles I help people with, but there's a lot of principles that can be boiled down to, is the interviewer asking you a question that is not as wide of a scope as you have skill set for? And so the same way that you interview is almost the same way that you negotiate, meaning you generate all your leverage during the interview process, both in displaying your skill set, and part of the way you display your skill set is by knowing what's important to them. So that's why I was saying knowing their ethos is a key component, because there's a lot of things that any candidate, I'm sure, could say in any situation, but knowing what's important to them, you know, Chris Voss, never split the difference type stuff, what's the black swan piece of information that exists within this organization or this team or this hospital group. So those aspects are important to tease out so that you're not just answering the standard question they're asking you. You can start to really round up your answers, see around corners, and differentiate yourself as a candidate.
So do you actually go through a mock training with your clients? Because I could foresee you potentially having some, you know, layups where you're like, okay, well, this guy's, he's got it. He can speak. He can talk the talk. But I bet you probably get some disasters. So if people that you're like, shit, how am I going to help this guy? Right? I mean, so walk me through, think back and all the experience you have. Think about maybe one of your worst clients. Obviously, don't tell us who it was. But
their social security number is.
Yeah. But maybe walk us through like the toughest experience you've had to coach, and how, if it was successful or not, how did you manage to break through and get to, because I think a lot of these things are just
skills.
Yeah, I mean, you're skills. But like, I think you're born into it, right? I mean,
well, I think you work on them.
So anyway, yeah. That's the question. Like, bad experiences in the past with bad clients, and how to break them into something that makes them successful in this process.
Yeah, I like the question. You know, I've never had a bad client. I've had challenging clients.
Okay, fair enough.
But that's the business I'm in.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the way I like to serve. Anyway, I work with a lot of people who are very smart, very skilled, successful in their own right. One of the biggest themes I see is people not wanting to be, they would call it braggadocious. And the thing is, during an interview, it's time to sell, baby. So, you know, just the practice, though, of advocating for yourself in that way is one of the biggest challenges I work on. So, yes, the negotiation, the interview prep, we do a lot of tactical, you know, what are the words and the prep around that. But even before, I'm working on their nervous system and their mindset, you know, making sure that their somatic body and their mindset is primed to be able to say things that they maybe aren't used to about why they're great, or asking challenging questions in an interview to ensure that a company or a role is actually a fit for them. Sometimes people have challenges around that, and so that's where I start with them. Other people, like you said, they may not have those challenges. They can talk. And then so the other challenge is people are very verbose. They talk a lot. They ramble. They're not concise and impactful in their answers. And you know, one of the key pillars of executive presence is being concise. This is another thing that I teach, but executive presence is, I think, the number one differentiating factor. You take two people, two roles, same skill set and experience, but one person gets promoted, the other one doesn't. It's because they have executive presence. And so being able to display those pillars of executive presence early in the interview process is going to help you stand out as a candidate. So getting someone to be able to have tight, impactful answers that don't ramble, not only for how you come off, but a lot of interviews in tech are half an hour, 30 minutes, which is, in my opinion, way too short. You know, in my career, we had those at some of the companies I worked at. And I was just like, this is way too short. And I just watched how people would ramble and go on and on and on. And it cuts into the time that they have to ask questions at the end, because the interviewer is going to get through their questions, because that's a priority. But you want to be able to ask at least 1 to 3 questions, if you can, in an interview process, to at least try to have a semblance of a dialogue to understand if the role is generally a good fit for you. But you can also differentiate yourself as a candidate via the quality of the questions that you ask.
How can you dive a little bit into that? I found very intriguing the concept of executive presence. Can you dive and explain a little more and the kind of the nuance of it, and where people usually fall short, and maybe things they can do to
be more executive?
Yeah, sure. I love this topic so much. I kind of have built this and reverse engineered into what makes someone be able to develop executive presence through. I've had 5 different careers, the compensation HR career was just one of them. So I've navigated a lot of change, seen a lot of people move through organizations very well, and then started to embody some of that myself. So sort of tried to diagnose, how is this done? How is this replicable? So think of it like a tree with a root system. The root system is principle number one, which is being competent in your role, which is seems standard, but because it's standard, it needs to be there. But it's under the surface, right? No one actually truly sees that when it comes to executive presence. It's just assumed or implied, and it's a key foundation. The second part is being able to manage up. So this is, I liken it to if you're in a big river, if you don't manage up, that means you're not swimming, you're not trying to handle all the tasks that get sent your way, you're going to get pushed over the falls. If you kind of manage up, you're going to tread water, but you're going to get tired, and you're going to burn out. If you effectively manage up, you're actually going to be able to swim up against the current in advance. And that's basically managing up, is being able to push back, alter strategic direction, influence to say, I actually think we should go a different direction. Does this actually have to happen now? Things like that. Whether you're an individual contributor in your first day out of college, working in a job, all the way up to a VP, talking to the CEO, you're always managing up in some fashion.
Meaning if you see something that you think would be a wrong direction, to gear it to what you would see would be the correct direction in an effective
way. Right. A wrong direction, or even maybe it's the right direction, but you know, early in my career, I sacrificed a lot because I didn't have the wherewithal to speak up. They would say, hey, we need this Excel analysis done by tomorrow. And I'm look at the clock and it's like 4:58. Guess who's staying late?
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously hard work is important and being able to flex when appropriate is needed, but just doing that all the time, blindly saying yes to everything, it's not going to be conducive for your own well-being. And also maybe you have a team. And so being able to have like some structure and framework where you can push back or clarify. And once I started clarifying things, I realized, well, it's not actually do this quickly. I just wanted it this quickly. You know, a lot of times I would do those diving catches early in my career when I worked in corporate America in tech, and I'd do the analysis, I'd stay late, and then wouldn't use it for like 4 days. You know, it's like, well, I could have just done it as part of my normal work cadence and everything would have been okay, right? But I, at the time, I didn't have the courage to ask or to clarify with someone that I felt was, you know, on an org chart above me. And so that's where that principle came from.
How important is the more lighter side of things, like your look? Like, do you go into that, or do you feel that's a topic that is a little bit personal and as a coach, you shouldn't?
Like the way someone looks?
Yeah. Like, hey, the way man, I'm going themselves. For this killer job.
Yeah.
I've been turned down 3 times. I think I can walk the walk or talk the talk, but something's missing. In your comprehensive evaluation of these challenging characters, do you ever be like, dude, you got to like change your way you look. Like, we're going to cut your hair and like, with, you know, like, do you ever go into that? Do you think that that ever plays a role negatively? I guess that in tech, maybe not, but maybe I'm jumping the gun. I'm thinking in medicine, it tends to be a little bit more important.
I would say, I mean, look, software engineers show up and work to work in cargo shorts and sandals at some of the companies I worked at, right?
Okay.
I would say that would be a slight deviation from the dress code of the environment you guys are used to.
Right.
So, yeah, there's that aspect. I've never had somebody that where I felt the need to call it out, like you need a haircut or a shower or something like that.
Would you?
You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're paying me to coach.
Right?
Yeah, well, I'm here to see around corners that they're having trouble seeing around.
Right.
I'm here to help them intervene into a world that they're not seeing, because if you know, there's change isn't possible if you can't intervene into a world you cannot see. So, absolutely, I would say something. I work with a lot of women as well, and they're always like well presented. That's never been an issue. So, and some of the guys that I've worked with are, you know, also doing great in that department, or they work in an industry or environment that there's a wider margin, I guess you could say, of what's acceptable. So I haven't had to really say that to anyone, okay. But I definitely get very straight with people and say, these are areas that are an invitation for you to approve, and here's how we're going to do it.
Have you ever, I'm sure that you hire you, I mean, when if I were to hire you to help me, it's not like you're assuring that I'm going to get that job, right? I mean, you're coaching me, you're helping me. What's kind of your batting average of every client you take that's going for different positions? Do you have kind of like a 90% rate of success on the path that I'm coaching them through? Can you even put a number on that?
Yeah, it is in the 90s as far as do they eventually get a job? Yes. Correct. Are there L's along the way? Absolutely. From especially in today's job environment, it's pretty rock and roll out there. And so I think having a coach is helpful to make it through both from a tactical standpoint and just the support, the mindset, because I've navigated so much transition in my own career and even the worst economic scenarios from 2008 and 2009, that I'm just very confident that when someone's has the ambition and the intention, they will be able to make it through. But don't get me wrong, it is tough sometimes. I had a client who I helped her interview at 5 different companies. And obviously the 5th one hit.
Okay.
But there were some heartbreakers before that, you know, like 10 rounds of interviews. Hey, they take you out to dinner. We just want you to meet one more C-suite person.
Yeah.
And then the earnings call happens the next day and they announce a restructuring. Position goes away. Right. You know, stuff like that. Or she also interviewed at another company right after because she had multiple processes going and made it final rounds and said, gosh, you're so great. But we just went with somebody who had a little bit more direct industry experience. And it's like, well, you could see that on my resume when we first started talking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So,
Miguel, you've been through some of these kind of like more senior negotiations. Is there anything that when you went into them, you wished you had somebody help you with?
For myself?
No, I'm asking Miguel.
Oh, sorry.
So to my point before, and I know this is not necessarily the specifics of today's, but I felt ill-prepared on understanding the jargon when the contracts would come through, right? I mean, the legal structure of a lot of these things and some of the compensation plans was, to me, a little bit, I was unclear to me, and it made me realize the importance of having a lawyer look at your contract. For the interview process, I don't think it's been that many. And usually by the time you get to senior positions in healthcare, it's more like they're recruiting you. Mm. They're looking for you and they're trying to get you somehow to come and take their meetings. Because normally when you get to those positions, you're not necessarily jumping ships too much in healthcare. So I feel I feel all this, the conversation that we're having here with Aaron today, I find it super interesting framing it more in residents or fellows trying to get into a program.
Yeah, but there's some mid-career people.
So, yeah,
your 5, 6,
I would say
7,
the mid-career
years.
People start jumping a lot. But I don't know. I feel like we're a little bit biased because there's too little of us. So for you to go and find a vascular surgery job tomorrow, it's probably relatively easy.
Yeah.
Whereas tech right now, I think, is probably super complicated. Aaron, what do you think about, I know this is a weird kind of spinoff, but it's just thinking about this and talking about, how do you think the nuance of artificial intelligence is going to affect the job landscape? It seems to me that we're going to need a lot more coaching, especially in tech, as a lot of these positions start being taken over by machines. And we're going to have to be prepared for that. Like, it's almost like we need to be a superhuman to be able to be considered for these positions because the basic, easy ones are going to be taken up by computers. What's your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be massively impactful and there will be a big transition. A lot of jobs will be lost. In some degree, I think some of those roles while obviously transition is tough and learning new skills is tough, there are some jobs I think that just a human shouldn't have to do. The time spent is just not, you know, conducive to a human's highest expression, right? But in the moment, it's going to be painful, of course, any type of transition is. There's also, I think the jury still feels like the jury's out on this, because there hasn't been a technological, you know, transformation or revolution where it didn't actually create more jobs and more opportunity. And so the jury's still out on, will AI be the first one where it doesn't? And it's interesting because that's kind of the point of a lot of the AI technologies and applications, is to create these scales and efficiencies. But then it births, you know, ancillary roles and opportunities. So then that's obviously what technology has always done. It's just created new things in new areas, kind of like 0 to 1 moments. I think, you know, pre-internet, there wasn't the need for, you know, massive web architecture development, and software engineering was not as, it wasn't as in demand, right? And so then in the mid to late, in the mid 2000s up until like essentially now, the growth of the software engineer and how much software engineers are paid has just gone virtually parabolic, except for the last 2 years. It's pumped the brakes a bit. But in the wake of that, we also seen information security, you know, cybersecurity professionals grow in some cases even more than software engineer. Like standard as a title, software engineer, I know there's a lot of flavors of it, but there's always going to be something. Really, it's about skill sets. And, you know, if you see that your role and your skill set and what you do is soon to be automated away, it's time to start thinking about a transition path to where you can contribute your value and your insight and your passion in a new way that will be conducive to the new environment.
Aaron, if you could kind of flip it, you know, flip the consulting that you do in its head, and you are in the other role, you're in the role of starting, like Miguel, like your own practice, your own business. How would you construct the interview process, and what are like things that should be like on your radar when you're building your team, as far as like traits that you that make a great team? So traits that the individuals have that when they come together as a collective, they will make a great team.
What a good question, by the way.
Yeah,
you're really good at this, Lucas.
It's like you've done this before.
Look at you. Coffee drinking.
Yeah.
I think passion pays dividends. And so what I've always screened for and would advocate anyone who is hiring one person or a whole organization just setting a culture is the person that you're considering for the position truly passionate about the skill set, the actual work? Because it's, and I've been there before, but done jobs just because it paid a lot, mm-hmm. you know, not because I actually liked it. And, you know, I have my own personal bar, my own personal standard of excellence. But what is the cost of pushing? A life of push is a lot more costly to the individual and sometimes to the people around them than a life of pull, feeling compelled and drawn to do something. So that right there is kind of a framework for just screen for the passion. And, you know, some people love accounting, other people don't, right?
Yeah.
So that's like number one. Number two, obviously, is skill set. But really, it's about obviously the stage of the person's career and the level of the job that you're going for. If it's in the beginning, you know, you have a bit more leeway. If you want something someone very senior, either an individual contributor or someone in management, obviously they're going to need to have a deep expertise in what they're doing. But what I'm really getting at is the intangibles. Companies should do the best they can to screen for the intangibles of candidates, meaning someone who's has the intellect, the autonomous thinking, the drive, the passion, the genuine alignment, because a lot of that, a person like that could be put into many different scenarios and figure things out and do a great job rather than someone who's maybe does have a lot of experience, but they hate it. And they've been doing it a long time. They just hashtag over it.
Yeah.
So that refreshed lens with that sort of forward momentum and velocity of just oomph of wanting to do something new or do something hard and different is really important. You know, a lot of companies I've worked at were difficult environments, SpaceX most notably. And it takes a certain caliber of person, yes, but also a certain caliber of outlook just to be in an environment like that and not just survive, but thrive just because of the pace and the intensity and the complexity. So being able to screen for that your environment and the candidate are matched is really important, because there's a lot of people who can do the job, but maybe they don't want to go as fast as you. They want more support. It doesn't make it bad or wrong. It's just, is it a fit? So making sure those intangibles are, you know, that as an employer up front, so you can screen for it rather than say, well, so-and-so isn't performing well. It's like, well, what was your intake process? Did you set them up for success? Did you tell them what the environment was like? You know, were you honest with them? There's a lot more to say about this, but that's some of the most important highlights I'd like to tell you.
It's so hard though, Aaron, right? I'm speaking on, you know, as an entrepreneur, medical entrepreneur. I quit the corporate jobs about, 2 years now? And build my own thing, and from the bottom, from zero, from going to the bank and trying to convince the bank to give me money, to then the bank screwing you, to then finding other banks, and then hiring the people along the way. But nobody's really committed to this plan, because you're the only one that will lose your house if this doesn't work, right? Everybody else has a job, but then you have the pressure of this, of making sure that they have that job, and that continues to be. But it's easier said than done to identify in such a, what seems to be a very crude process, these intangibles that you mentioned, because I totally agree with you as you're eloquently laying it out there. I'm like, yeah, that's exactly what you're liking, what you need to look for in an employee. But it's so hard, because what do I get? I mean, I put a thing on Indeed, I get flooded with a bunch of bullshit. I have to look through all the CVs. Half of them are trash. Then some of them are okay. Then you kind of tease away, okay, well, there's these things that you kind of like. And then you have to meet them. And how do you meet all these people, right? I mean, one thing that I did, and I mean, tell me if this is maybe one thing, because I want you to expand on a potential strategy to try to tease these things out of people. But one thing I did is I did my first two or three hires with like Zoom interviews, because I was, you know, we were coming out of the pandemic. It was still a thing. And I was like, this is trash. When I met them in person, I had essentially hired them, somebody that I'd never met.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't like the vibe.
Yeah.
And it was like then weird, because I needed to somehow get this person out of my company.
Yeah.
Because the culture, the vibe, whatever I was getting, there's this je ne sais quoi that you can put your hands on, but it just did not work for what we were looking or what I was looking for. And that day I said, I changed my cassette and I only interview people in person, and in the perfect scenario, we are actually going to eat together.
Mm.
I know that sounds weird.
Yeah.
But I will go either a breakfast. Hey, meet me for breakfast at this place. And I'm like, and you're not just sitting. I'm not interviewing while I eat. You and I are going to eat.
Okay.
And I want to just see you eat. I know that's weird, right?
It's pretty weird.
I want to see you order food.
Yeah.
I want to see you interact with the waiter.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I want to see, you know, and then I'll see how organically the conversation comes through.
Yeah.
And that's what I've like identified as something that works for me, Aaron, and it may be very personal, but you know, what do you think about that strategy? Is that weird if you were like coaching somebody applying for my job and he's like, Aaron, so this weirdo wants to go and eat and I have to eat. Like he said, I can't just sit. Like I have to order a drink and I have to eat. What's your thoughts?
I mean, weird is subjective. It's definitely a little idiosyncratic, but it's not bad. I mean, listen, what is your company, by the way?
It's Hope Vascular and Podiatry.
Okay.
it's a clinic that, I mean, it's a medical practice. It's a private medical practice that focuses on the management of patients with leg vascular, like blood flow problems of their legs and diabetic foot. And we, our objective is to avoid amputations and make people walk around the world in an appropriate way.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So that right there is a good North Star, a vision. And that's how you can test for passion and these intangibles. You know, being in person with the someone that you're interviewing, and you say something like that, more about what is the purpose and the ethos of your medical practice? Why did you, as a highly skilled medical professional, leave, you know, the corporate side to start your own thing and take on all that risk? You know, share that passion and vision with the people that you're interviewing, because they're all force multipliers for you. And if they carry the same, at least intellectual understanding, and, you know, they connect with as best they can on the actual why they're there. But the why is really important. You're getting a little Simon Sinek on you. Mm-hmm. But I would also say getting them in person, wanting them to order a meal, fine. Because, I mean, you're also in the patient-facing business, right? So that the bedside manner and just how someone feels coming into your practice is very important. But how do you have a process around the way you communicate your vision, just as you told me?
Yeah, I don't, you know, I think that you bring in a great point, which is the reaction to that. And maybe it was something that I didn't do thoughtfully, meaning I didn't do it purposely. But I would, you know, part of this, you know, meal that we're, you know, part of breaking bread with this stranger, because that's what's weird. And again, I'm sitting down with a stranger to eat, right? To break bread, which is odd. It's uncomfortable, right? I'm not making them eat like bolognese, which is going to be a mess, but anybody can eat anything. But I usually just start the conversation with, hey, here's who I am. And this is what I did. And I gave up on this, but I love what I'm doing and I'm super excited. And I'm looking for somebody that I guess would get as excited as me and understands the bigger picture. And I never quite did it purposely to understand what the, or to measure the reaction. But to your point, I guess that was maybe part of why I would like these things, because that's the way that you can see if you've counter-ignited somebody, if there is that passion in there. I mean, it's never going to be the same, right? I mean, it's not their dream, but if you can see that these people can put, you know, can follow you and can get behind you in the right way, it just, I think that's super interesting. And I think that you're putting it in a really good way where I probably should purposely do it and see what the reaction to that is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're in a business that is impactful. You're not like, oh, this is a DTC product where, you know, we just want to, we think it's high margin. We think it'll sell well, right? You're genuinely like changing lives. When I was at SpaceX, we had massive cachet. It just was so cool, right? And we would get people to come from other cool companies and we'd pull them out of there. They wouldn't think about leaving Google or wherever else. But it's like, do you want to write software for a search engine or for autonomous software to dock Dragon autonomously on ISS? Yeah. You know? Yeah. So like you can, that's obviously like a pretty heavy hitter thing that not a lot of companies can say in tech. But what is your version of that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, do you want to save someone's future for not having to be an amputee?
Right.
But also, something that just came up for me, a strategy for you, rather than just the Indeed, is creating community for you, creating maybe, you're doing this, which is a personal brand, which is awesome. But how can you lean more into creating awareness around the ethos of why you started your clinic? And then that will just create people who are naturally aligned to the mission. And then occasionally you can drop like, hey, by the way, we're hiring somebody. And so you have a natural funnel. I don't know if you're already, maybe you're already doing this, but that's
an area I would go. Non-intentionally, but I think that you bring another exceptional point. That's great, by the way. This idea of having free coaching is great. We should have Aaron. Aaron, can you do one show a week? Aaron, can you do one show a week?
I'll send you a bill.
No, but no, really, because it's, if you think about it, you know, we are developing, you know, our social media strategies and this whole thing. And it is true that I think what we're building is a community, right? Mm. And there are going to be people inspired by the mission that would become huge advocates of the brand, right? Of the goal. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that we're there. But as we mature, I think that should be one of the things that we should try to manifest, is create a funnel of people internally that you don't, you know, to your point, right? As SpaceX, shit, if anybody put a chief medical officer position for somebody with expertise in vascular surgery, because we're seeing, I don't know, deep venous thromboses on zero gravity, I would like die for that job. Yeah. Like tomorrow, I'd leave everything behind. I'd chapter 11 this. Well, maybe not. That sounds bad. But no. But what I'm saying is, why? Because I just feel that's such a cool mission, right? The thought of exploring and gaining and the mission and, you know, galaxies and all these.
Yeah, you'll just give them like STDs and they'll be your whole job.
What? Yeah. Oh, an STD. No, okay. Thanks for crumbling my dreams. But all I'm just saying is, like, SpaceX doesn't go to Indeed, probably, right? Yeah. You go to SpaceX.
Right.
And that's something that we can potentially do here, which is hope doesn't go to you. You go to hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's about people self-selecting.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Because you're not looking to hire so many people. You don't need to hire as many people as SpaceX did or does.
True.
We hired 1,000 people a year when I was there.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And did every offer manually too. So I've done 3,000 job offers personally.
Well,
which is not necessarily, it sounds like a flex. It's actually a sign of a lot of infrastructure we had to put in place so that wouldn't be necessary. But because of the consequence of being in an environment that was very unstructured, that needed structure, that was the type of experience that I got. And I'm kind of like my own walking AI model algorithm of a great party trick, I guess, people's compensation.
So. Like, let me analyze your compensation over this drink.
If it's a W-2 great,
like,
job.
That's a great like first date starting. Like,
yeah, exactly. I'm not going to ask you how much you make. I'm going to tell you how much
you
make.
Exactly.
Yeah. But Miguel, I think I can see, you know, you're onto something here. And I think there's a big opportunity for you to hone your message and hone the focus on your why so that people can self-select into that world. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you can cherry pick people who really, really want to be part of the mission. And then you can screen on skill set after that. But the initial screening should be on the intangibles, as a process where people self-select and opt in. Because not because it's just a job, because it's a job that resonates with them. Because yes, you're the owner, they're not, you know, you have more of a financial incentive than them. Better. But
no, that's a great, I mean, I think passion trumps everything, to be honest. I mean,
yeah,
even probably if I had to choose passion or skill set, if the skill set is something that I could teach that person, I'll choose passion all day. Just because that person will out-compete everyone else over the 100%. Long term.
Yeah. When I go at a restaurant and the server has that unique attention, very attentive, aware, you can tell they care.
Yeah.
When I'm, you know, someone services, you know, something with my car, or if I'm just hotel reception, whatever the case may be, you can just tell who stands out. Because if you stand out in jobs like that, in my opinion, those are kind of tough jobs to do, because like they're not always that exciting. They don't always pay super well, right? So when someone can display those characteristics in an environment like that, oh my gosh, they need to
succeed anywhere else, right?
I bought some clothes once, I think from Rag & Bone on South Congress. And I told the woman that helped me at the end, she walked me to the door and I said it so her manager wouldn't hear, but I was like, you are excellent. You have great attention to detail, very personable. Find an environment to do this where you can earn more.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Well, and in that note...
I'm back. Why are you trying to steal my coaching session? You sent me on some dumb...
Yeah. Well, you bailed on it.
Yeah. I'm like, back, man. I'm regaining my time.
Stop asking speaker. For things for free.
Yeah. No, Aaron, yeah. I think you've been incredibly awesome to talk to. I've personally squeezed a lot of great pearls of information out of you.
Well, he has a business, which you can...
I'm sure that on the notes of the show down below, there's going to be all the information about your company. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's time to branch into healthcare. I mean, why not? Why only tech? There's med tech.
Yeah. You know, make a little. The salary negotiation is just one aspect of what I do. Ultimately, I coach the whole person in all realms and industry agnostic. So it's really the psychographic more than the demographic. It's someone who is ambitious, trying to find new ways to do new things and not lose themselves in the process.
So if anybody's looking for connecting with you and potentially looking at the possibility of you two working together, what's the best way?
So my company is resparkcoaching.com. So resparkcoaching.com is my website. You can find me on LinkedIn or Instagram. My name, Aaron, with two A's. Last name is Tweet, T-H-W-E-A-T-T. So on all platforms. But whether it's my website, resparkcoaching.com, or on the Instagrams or LinkedIn, it's the best way to find me. I'd love to have a conversation.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aaron.
Make this sure you really add to your profile that you were on this podcast. It's going to just kill your numbers. Like, it's gonna be, there's going to be clients up the wazoo from now on. Okay, man?
Delusion at the moment here.
But yeah. Manifesting.
You're manifesting. Yeah.
Well, I love the name of the podcast and the energy you guys bring. It's The Life of Flow, which is such a cool name, and you guys are doing it in such a unique way. And I think this is a good synergy for us to have this conversation today because I help people with flow in a different way. The flow of their conversations, their energy, and you guys are actually helping direct their literal flow within their vessels. So pretty cool. I appreciate being on today.
Well, that's a beautiful way to wrap it up. Yeah. And I appreciate you here, and hopefully we'll have another conversation down the line and look at other aspects of life. Thank you, Aaron.
This was great. Thank you.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.